Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Paperback writer.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we continue our regional author series featuring new books by writers who are proud to call North Central Wisconsin their home. Today, we welcome back to our Wisconsin Public Radio studios Wausau's own Sandra Kring, a best-selling author whose new book, A Life of Bright Ideas, has just come out in paperback. The book is set in the late 60s and early 70s, with its main character, a conservative, traditional young Wisconsin lady confronted by her childhood best friend, who returns home in a psychedelic VW microbus as a decidedly free-spirited rebel. The book is a follow-up to Sandra's earlier novel, The Book of Bright Ideas, which profiled the adventures of those two best friends as pre-teenagers. Sandra Kring's own life story is inspirational, both in terms of the material that it provides for the characters in her books, and also as a personal story of redemption. Last May, after Sandra's first appearance on Route 51, I filed a news report about our conversation on the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Sandra Kring is the author of four critically acclaimed novels published by Random House, each set in Wisconsin, about people who use humor and courage to resolve old family issues.
When I sold my first book back in 2003, if someone had suggested to me that I would be volunteering to do it, to talk about my history, I wouldn't have believed it. I believed at that time I was putting my past behind me.
Her past included growing up in Ladysmith with three brothers, a father who was often away from home because of work, and an abusive and violent mother.
She was severely mentally ill. She was extremely violent, and especially towards me. You know, she chased us with knives. She did a lot of horrible things that would probably end up in a Stephen King book.
Kring says the years of abuse scarred her as a young girl.
School meant nothing to me. How do you concentrate in a classroom when you worry if your little brothers will be alive when you get home?
And left her emotionally crippled as a young woman.
By the time I was an adult, I was sleeping, fully clothed, and with my shoes on, glasses on, because I couldn't get rid of that feeling that I might have to run in the night. I also had very low self-esteem. I thought I was too stupid to get a job because I had dumb just literally beaten into me, and I believed that.
Kring married a logger at the age of 17. She raised three children as a stay-at-home mom and lacked the confidence to work full-time. But she found a refuge in books and literature, and found salvation in a quote by philosopher and psychologist James Hillman.
The quote was, "To heal the person, we must first heal the story they imagine themselves to be in."
Sandra Kring realized that her beliefs about her own story were holding her back.
I had believed a lot of things that weren't true. In many ways, my story was already like a piece of fiction. I wasn't dumb. I wasn't worthless. I could amount to something.
And Kring, who had always dreamed about being a writer, looked at her own life as if it was an unfinished novel.
There's no other way to say it. I suffered. And yet I looked at my life story and I thought, if I was writing this as a work of fiction, what would I do? What would I have happened to make this a successful story?
Sandra Kring, as the main character in her own story, took a leap of faith and believed she could change the second half of the novel she was living.
I thought, you know, I can rewrite my life. At least the last half of my life, and I decided that one way or another, I was going to make the second half of my life every bit as joyful as the beginning was painful, and that's what I did.
And she hopes by speaking out, she can empower other abuse victims to rewrite the stories of their lives.
They have so much fear, just like I had once. I'm comfortable in my own skin, and I don't apologize anymore for the very breath I take, you know, which at one time would have seemed like I should save that for someone else.
Sandra Kring was 48 years old when her first book, Carry Me Home, was published. She has also written and published The Book of Bright Ideas, Thank You for All Things, and How High the Moon, and plans to release a fifth novel early next year. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Well, that story was filed in May of last year, and it is early that next year now, and Sandra Kring does indeed have a new novel out. It's called A Life of Bright Ideas, and we are pleased to welcome her back to our Wisconsin Public Radio studios. Sandra, thanks so much for being back with us again.
Thank you for having me, Glenn.
And if you're a fan of Sandra's books, or if you're inspired by her story, well, we've got her with us for the next 50 minutes. We would love to have you join the conversation. Here's the number, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Sandra, you dedicate your book for the readers who would not let me rest until I went back to Dauber to find out what happened next.
Yes, I would say that 98% of my fan mail on the Book of Bright Ideas was readers asking me, where's the sequel? In fact, one woman sent me 7 pages of possible sequel ideas. I mean, they were just so eager to get that book, and it took me a long time to let those characters grow up in my mind. But I finally felt ready to tackle it.
In the first book, how old were they?
The girls were 9.
And in the second book?
18.
So it's been 9 years that has passed in Dauber, Wisconsin, which I can't find on my Wisconsin atlas.
It's not there.
Where is it? I mean, fictionally speaking, about where in the state is
Dauber? I would say north central Wisconsin, somewhere probably up around where I used to live, up in Price County, that area.
So most of your books, if not all of them, are based in Wisconsin.
All of them. I've only lived in Wisconsin, and I'm really not comfortable writing about an area that I haven't lived on, you know, in, because, you know, different areas, there's a lot of nuances with the people, and I wouldn't feel comfortable. Wisconsin's what I know. The people are what I know.
You know, another writer who lives in the area, Victoria Houston,
yes,
once tried to write a book, she said, about Kansas City. And in the book about Kansas City, she had a paragraph or a chapter which went back to northern Wisconsin, and her editor at the time said, why don't you write about northern Wisconsin?
Right.
The book just comes alive.
Right.
So I guess it really does matter that you write about the things that touch you emotionally.
Right. And two, my publishing house, Random House, has even asked me to keep my book centered in Wisconsin, because apparently Wisconsin is a very popular location for novels.
There you go. Well, tell us about this new novel and its relationship to the earlier one, The Book of Bright Ideas.
Well, in this one, the story begins, and Button, the protagonist in the story, her mother is dead. Her family has kind of fallen apart. After the Malones were there the first time, they helped a lot of healing in the family. And it's kind of fallen apart. The father has stepped out of the raising of her and her little brother, Boohoo, leaving the responsibilities to Button and her aunt and uncle. And Button's kind of lost.
And the Malones were the family of her other childhood friend, Winnelly.
Right, yes, Winnelly and Frida.
Mm-hmm. And so they moved away.
Yes, left without warning, just left.
And then Button's mother dies,
yes,
and the father withdraws, becomes
mm-hmm.
depressed.
Yes.
And then suddenly Winnelly shows up nine
yeah,
years later.
A hippie, a total hippie. And I might add, I kind of laughed when I was listening to your music at the opening, because I played music from that era like I always do, you know, with the story. And one day I happened to be in the store and I looked down and I'm dressed like a hippie, I mean, from head to toe. And I thought, wow. I mean, I get into the character and I get into the time period, and the music always helps me do that.
Why did you choose this particular era for the sequel? Why did you wait 9 years to get these characters back together again?
I wanted the girls, I wanted to catch them at that stage where they have 1 foot in childhood and 1 foot in womanhood, you know, so that I could keep the characters sounding like themselves, but yet have them matured some. So I thought 18 was the perfect age to put them at.
So the one character is very conservative.
Yes.
The protagonist,
yes.
Button. And the other is the free spirit, yes. the hippie, the, mm-hmm. you know, use any adjectives or nouns that you want. But that main character, Button or Evie, narrates the story in the first person. Is she autobiographical in some sense?
Oh, not any more than any other protagonist I've ever written. I'm always a piece of my protagonist, always. So she's a piece of me. But there's also a part of me that was very much like Winnie, too. They're like polar sides of me at that age.
And did you draw that inspiration for Winnie from anybody other than yourself?
No.
Going back mm-hmm. to the 70s or the late 60s? I mean, they were very, very tumultuous times. How old were you when all of that was happening?
Now you're going to ask me times and dates, which I'm awful with. At this age, I was younger than that. I was about 14.
About 14.
14, yes.
So you didn't experience all of that firsthand
no.
like I did because I was 18 years
okay.
old in 1970.
All right. Okay. I don't know. It's just imagination. And I saw enough of those times though. You know, I grew up fast, so I saw those times anyway. So
you have the conservative and somewhat repressed Button.
Yes.
And you have her best friend, the free spirit, Winnie. What's the key to the tension and also the attraction between these two friends?
I think their history is most of their connection at that point. Had they met at 18, they probably would have just both kept walking in a different direction. But they had that history together, that bond that they made in childhood. The friction, of course, is that Button just doesn't understand Winnie's lifestyle. It scares her, but at the same time, it intrigues her, too.
And then you've got Button's adopted mother, Aunt Verdella. What makes her tick? Where did you find the inspiration for her?
Aunt Verdella is, in many ways, a little bit of some different older women that I knew. In particular, this one who was a role model to me when I was a young woman and who was a book club member for years in the book club I belong to still up north, and she recently passed away just this past month. But she was that loving kind of person, you know, sometimes a little dingy, a little off the wall, but so loving and so non-judgmental, mm-hmm. and I just thought she'd make a great character.
And then you've got Button's own biological mother, who was killed in an accident mm-hmm. Just a few years before the story begins
right.
in the new book, The Life of Bright Ideas. Right. It was an event that scarred Button. She had trouble relating to her mom early in life. You write, and then they developed a closer relationship between the two of them, yes. only to have all of that taken away. How central is that history to what happens in the story?
Very much so, I think, because you know, Button had a lot to resolve there. How do you resolve your feelings about someone that you both feared at one point and came to love at another point? She really struggles with that. And also with her role. What is her role in her family? At being 18 years old, at a time when other girls are going out into their future, she feels stuck at home, stuck in Dauber to help raise her little brother. So,
are there parallels between that and your own life with your own troubled relationship
yes.
with your mother and having to take care of your siblings when you were growing up?
Yes, yes, except we never had that healing when she was alive that Button had. But yes, definitely, because I certainly felt like my life had to be, you know, put on the back burner, not just when I was a child, but then, of course, I became a child mother myself. So my life was always about taking care of the little ones.
And yet you went through all of that yourself, and you still were able to realize your childhood dream of being an author. It took you until you were 48.
Yes. Well, actually, I didn't dream of being a writer, though, when I was a child. I just dreamt of owning books at that point, and I didn't start reading till I was 17. Until I read the James Hillman quote that you gave, I didn't think about being a writer until that moment, actually. I thought of doing something with my life. By that time, I decided that I can't keep going like this. My children were growing up, and I thought, if I only am living for them, I'm going to become one of those mothers, you know, who's calling every 10 minutes and, you know, too much in their lives, not letting them go. And so I read that quote, and that's when I got the idea of, I know what I do, you know.
So the icy relationship, mm-hmm. and the tragedy between Button and her mom, that's a parallel with your life. What about what happens with Button's father, who withdraws and becomes depressed, and mm-hmm. there's another situation where the parents aren't there for the kids?
Right. That was my father. It's not like he was there and then withdrew. I just never really knew my father. He was under the same roof, but, you know, he worked hard. He drank equally as hard, and was not home often, and sometimes was gone for months at a time working away when I was a child. But we did heal that, I'd say, by the time he died.
Let me read a paragraph from the book that I pulled out. And this is Ann Ferdella talking to Button. Your mom and dad's marriage had gone sour so long ago, and I doubt they even tasted the bitterness anymore. And your ma, so judgmental and jealous and cold to you and your dad. I told myself that's just how she was made, because nothing ever seemed to change it. It broke my heart, though, the way she had you so scared of doing something wrong that you couldn't stop scratching yourself. Remember how you used to chew the insides of your cheeks until they bled? I slid my tongue over to cover the jagged, tender skin in my mouth, as if she'd see the damage right through my cheek if I didn't.
And that directly did come from my life, because I was always scratching my skin full of rash, and I did chew the inside of my cheek until a dentist did say that you're going to chew a hole right through it. You know, it's what I did with my anxiety. It's my way of keeping it in, or trying to keep it in anyway.
Well, let's look at Winnalee now. This is mm-hmm. the other half of your personality. Talk about that.
Okay. In my home, I felt a lot of anxiety, of course. I felt a lot of resentment. I got a lot of negative messages. But outside in the world, in school, in my life outside of the home, I was always treated well, always. I always had friends. I had fun. I was kind of a different person when I was outside of that house. So Winnalee, in a way, was that. I wasn't quite as wild as Winnalee. I mean, I didn't get into the drug scene and all that, but I certainly got into having fun, and I was, you know, a real free spirit outside of the house.
Now Winnalee is very promiscuous. I mean,
yes.
Even for a hippie.
That
right?
Didn't come from my life.
What makes her discount the possibility of real serious love and immerse herself in this whole string of casual relationships?
Well, she got that by example. Her sister, Frida, well, really her mother in the first book, she thought she was her sister. Frida had been a victim of sexual abuse. So she didn't believe in things like love. You know, she believed that that's what she was made for, that she would always be used that way by males. So she took control of that by being very promiscuous, but always picking the men. And Winnalee watched this. This is Frida changed over time as she healed, but that's what Winnalee saw during her formative years, and she really was acting that out. That, topped with the era itself, of course, of free love, it kind of gave her extra permission.
Sandra Kring, she is a Wausau's own and a nationally published, best-selling author, critically acclaimed. She's got a brand new book out called A Life of Bright Ideas. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51, our regional author series, continuing with Sandra Kring, who was with us a little less than a year ago and is now back to talk about her new book, A Life of Bright Ideas. Let's talk about Boohoo,
yes.
the little six-year-old in the book who, if my son finds out that I'm going to tell you this, he's going to be very upset with me, but he reminds me of my son when he was 6 years old, wild, always getting into trouble, and somehow having a pure heart in the midst of all of that.
That was Boohoo, definitely. I have three brothers, two of them younger, and of course I had a son, still have a son, but I mean a young son. And so I'm well familiar with active little boys.
And he really does add a lot of comic relief
to
the book.
Yes, and I always try to do that in my books because often I'm dealing with heavy themes, and I want my books to be like the books I like to read, a little bit more like real life, so that, you know, it has the angst, it has the sorrow, the tension, but it also has that comic aspect to it.
Here's another paragraph that I picked out, and you've got Button working she's making wedding dresses in a shop. Mm-hmm. I turned, and there was Boohoo, his muddy knee hooked on the edge of my work table, one leg teetering on a footstool. Boohoo, I screeched. He was on the table. By the time I got to my feet, his grubby hands reaching for the fat toad tangled with orange yarn that hopped over Joe's gown. What are you doing? I shouted when I saw the snow-white skirt folding like an accordion under Boohoo's grubby knees, tiny clumps of damp soil dropping from his mitts as the toad leapt out of his hand, and he reached for him again. Don't worry, Evie, I got him, I got him. Boohoo stood up on the dress, and when I screamed, he quickly leapt to the floor. He held up his hand, his fingers squishing the toad's pale green pot belly, its legs dangling. That's every six-year-old boy in Wisconsin.
Yes. Oh, yes. I remember when I was, well, about the age when that book took place, living across the street from my best friend and my little brother and her little brother being best friends, and them chasing us with toads, with snakes. You know, it's a boy's life, and comical now, it wasn't then, and neither was it for Button at the time.
It caused a great deal of trouble for her when she was trying to get that wedding dress ready.
Yes.
We're talking to Sandra Kring. The new book is called A Life of Bright Ideas. It's the follow-up to the best-selling The Book of Bright Ideas. She lives in Wausau. She is somebody who is inspirational in her own right. She has overcome a childhood of abuse and ended up realizing a lifelong dream of becoming a successful author. We're going to talk more about the book and more about that when Route 51 Regional Talk Radio continues right after this news. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg, and our guest today, Sandra Kring, as we continue our Regional Authors Series featuring authors who live in North Central Wisconsin and their latest books. Sandra's latest book is called A Life of Bright Ideas. It's a sequel to the best-selling The Book of Bright Ideas. And Sandra, you've written three other books as well, correct?
This book is my fifth, so...
So one is Carry Me Home, and the other two titles?
Carry Me Home, How High the Moon, and Thank You for All Things.
What are the common threads in all of your books?
The common threads, well, they're all told through the voice, an innocent voice, a child or at least someone childlike, all in first person. Usually they're overcoming something, you know, there's been some trauma. I tend to not write in the moment in that trauma, but they're trying to heal old hurts, I guess you'd say. And I always have a lot of hope in the books, always.
And who are your readers? Have they broken that down demographically for you, or do you even care about that?
I kind of know who my readers are. Carry Me Home was, I was basically writing about a man's world, so I got a lot of male readers on that. The rest of my books, of course, mostly women. It's women's fiction. Age-wise, though, everything from 14 to, I think, the oldest fan I heard from was 92. So,
and you have managed to achieve success And your books are published by a major publisher, yes, and they sell very well. Mm-hmm. And you still live in central Wisconsin. You could live anywhere.
You know, it's kind of a funny story. When I first moved to Wausau, I was over at Barnes & Noble, and I happened to start a conversation with two women while I was browsing books. And one of them had suggested a particular book to me, and I said, well, I can't read right now, but I'm going to keep that in mind. And she says, oh, and asked a question. I said, well, I'm a writer, and I can't read fiction and write it at the same time. And just like that, she stopped, and she goes, are you the one who wrote A Book of Bright Ideas? I said, yes. And she says, oh, you've got to come in the back. My friend's back there. That's her ultimate favorite book. I told her you lived in Wausau. And I went back there, and that woman was just so thrilled but shocked, too. And she said to me, I thought she's crazy when she said she lived here. Of course, City Pages had done the story. And she said, I was sure you lived in swanky Manhattan or something. I said, I wouldn't get any work done if I lived there. Wisconsin's a great place to write, actually.
How did you find your voice as a writer? Was this something that developed internally, or did you, when you were first starting to write, did you model yourself consciously after other writers?
No, not at all, because I figured I couldn't do a good job mimicking them anyway. I hear this a lot, and I know writers make this mistake a lot, aspiring writers, is trying to sound like their favorite writers. And I knew I couldn't do that. I just started writing, and whatever came, came. And that's the way books always happen for me. It's my particular voice. I couldn't change it. It's the one that comes naturally to me. Even the voice of a child comes naturally to me. So I just sit down and let the story write itself.
Sandra Kring, she is the author of five best-selling books, including the new one that she's just released called A Life of Bright Ideas. If you would like to talk to Sandra, if you were listening during the first half hour, she's had an inspirational story. She grew up in an abusive childhood. She has worked with adult victims of trauma, survivors of similar abusive backgrounds, and yet she has managed to turn her life around and achieve success, she says, by rewriting her own life story. We're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. But again, we'd love to have you join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. Sandra, can you read a segment of this latest book for us?
Sure. This comes from the prologue, and Button is recounting the night her mother died. Aunt Verdella's hand didn't drift off until she did, and she moaned in her sleep. I lay still at the edge of bed for hours, my eyelids slammed shut to keep in the tears. And when sobs formed in my chest, I bit the inside of my cheek until I tasted blood, which felt easier to swallow than grief. I knew that if Aunt Verdella woke, she'd only start crying along with me. So when I couldn't sleep or keep quiet any longer, I slipped out of bed, circled the couch so I wouldn't wake Uncle Rudy, and went outside. It was almost dawn, and the sky was still wearing the stains of yesterday's storms. It was misting and foggy, and wet grass clung to my bare feet like hair clippings as I hurried to the tree that had been every bit a part of my childhood as Winna Lee. We called it our magic tree because it spun us off to faraway places and brought us home by lunchtime. And after the Malones left without warning, our magic tree kept Winna Lee's Book of Bright Ideas for me until I found it. Just looking at that tree that had been the keeper of our innocence that summer of 1961 made my tears run like sap, and I ran stumbling to meet it, like people do when they're being reunited with family from across the sea. I hadn't climbed that tree since Winna Lee left, and my 14-year-old body, skinny and gangly as it was, felt heavy and awkward as I reached around a thick, low-hanging branch and swung my legs up to wrap around it. The bony bark scratched the inside of my thighs as I scooted down the limb, and Aunt Verdella's nightie bunching around my hips. The barkless platform in the fork of the tree that had once held two pairs of dusty feet couldn't contain my lady's size eights, but cupped my heels. I leaned back against one of the three thick limbs and looked up at branches that stretched toward heaven, as if they too were reaching for Ma. And then I begged the magic tree to take me away, far away to lands where fairies played and Winna Lee waited, where nothing could find me but innocence. Instead, it was Uncle Rudy who found me, sitting in the fork, straddling the limb I'd leaned against, my arms and legs wrapped around it like a child being carried. "Button," he called. I blinked awake and saw him below me, one hand extended and the other dangling at his side. The grass was bright from its washing, and Aunt Verdella's nightgown was damp on my skin. "Come on, honey," Uncle Rudy said. As he helped me down, I could see Aunt Verdella standing at the kitchen window, her hand pressed to her mouth. Uncle Rudy put one arm around me and took a photograph out of his pocket. "I ever show you this, Button?" he asked, handing it to me. "I took it up on Lake Superior when your dad and I went up there fishing, right after he graduated." I squinted at Uncle Rudy, who had shrunken to 5'7" while I was growing, his eyes now level with mine. I know, he said, nodding. "Looks impossible, doesn't it? A tree that size growing on the top of a big rock jutting out of the water, no soil beneath it. But looky here," he said, tracing his stiff finger along a thick rope that ran from the base of the tree across thin air, then disappeared off the edge of the page. "I didn't get it in the shot, but over here was a bluff some 20 feet from the rock, and these roots were stretched to it like an umbilical cord." He took his cap off, rubbed the top of his half-bald head, and pumped it back in place. "Anyway, I want you to have it," he said, giving me a pat. I didn't get the chance to ask him how that tree knew which direction to send its roots in, or how it survived until it reached solid ground, because Aunt Verdella was already on the porch, her arms reaching, and all I wanted was to get to them. But later, 4 years later to be exact, I came to understand for myself how that tree survived, and then how it thrived.
Sandra Kring from A Life of Bright Ideas. Sandra, the imagery is just so beautiful. Your metaphors are very, very beautiful. You write with a lot of metaphors.
I do.
But that one in particular, something that I think is probably very, very familiar to people who live in this part of the country. If you've gone to Lake Superior, if you've gone to a lot of our national forests, I feel I've seen that tree before. I've seen it clinging to that rock with the roots stretching off 20 feet in order to find nourishment. What made you choose that metaphor?
I hadn't seen the tree myself. A woman I met up in Rhinelander had gone kayaking up on Lake Superior, and she was showing me some photos, and there was the picture of this tree. And I loved it. I didn't know such things happened, actually, and I looked at it knowing that it would be the perfect metaphor for one of my books. And so I asked her to make me a copy, and she did, and I kept it up in my living room, and I knew it was going to get into a story one way or another, and this one it worked perfectly for.
Now, you, as we touched in the first half hour, you overcame a childhood of adversities, leaving you with a lot of insecurities. It was only late in life that you were able to realize that dream of becoming an author. Tell us again what it was like, you growing up as a child, and how you were able to turn all of that around.
You know, when I think back on childhood, and of course now it's a little bit foggier to me than it used to be because it seems so non-important to me anymore, believe it or not.
But I guess that happens when you overcome
it
something.
It does. It really does. I used to hear people say sometimes when they'd look back on their life, if it, you know, was tumultuous, and they'd say, but I wouldn't change anything. And I'd think, what are they talking about? And now I know. I mean, I look back and I think it was a hard beginning. But then again, you know, we all suffer in this life. Sooner or later, everyone suffers, whether it happens early on in your life, midlife, or later. And, you know, none of us are an exception to that. Some suffer more than others. But yet at the same time, you know, you overcome it because what is your choice? I lived in that misery once where every day was terrifying. My choice was to stay in that past and continue to live that life or to change it.
Whatever happened to your mom who used to chase you around with knives, whatever happened to her?
She lived a long life, I'll say that. Rather enjoyed herself, I might add. And, you know, I never was her caretaker in the same way maybe that my brothers were, but you know, later in life. I mean, I visited her. I mean, there was a stretch in my life when I was going through my healing when I had to avoid her. And after that, I didn't have to avoid her anymore. But we never, she admitted to how she had treated us. And she never said she was sorry. She just admitted it and, you know, kind of just blamed it on this, blamed it on that, that sort of thing.
When you got older and you'd gone through the healing process yourself, mm-hmm. you ended up working with other adults who were suffering from similar kinds of trauma.
Yes.
How did you help them overcome what they experienced?
Well, for starters, I'll say that I didn't really choose to do that. It was chosen for me.
How was that?
I knew other women like myself, of course, and one of them asked me, would you start a group? And I was at a stage in my life, I was finished with therapy. I just wanted to get on with life, and I didn't necessarily want to do that. But she seemed desperate, and pretty soon, you know, I've got 5, 6 who'd come, and pretty soon I had 40 who were coming. It was like that. And I stuck with it for 6 years. Helping them, as it turned out, was very easy because all I really needed to do were 2 things, basically, is to help them realize that they already survived it, that the danger was gone, and to recognize the strengths that got them through that, and to give them hope. And for whatever reason, hope is something I've always had. I just have always been a hopeful person, always believed that life would get better, that somehow I'd figure it out.
Well, you've talked in our last show about rewriting your life
yes.
story. An inspiring concept that we're all basically in control, that at any point in our lives we can decide, how do I want this to end? Let's mm-hmm. look like I'm a character in my own novel. How
yes.
do I want this book to end? Mm-hmm. But isn't that easier said than done? There's so many
yes.
people. Was it Shakespeare who said people who lead lives of quiet desperation, or I'm mixing up my my old authors, I may be. But how do you convince people who are trapped that they can break free, that they really have the power to do that?
I think, first of all, you do it by example. You know, seeing is believing. One thing I used to always try to get across, because I had to get it across to myself, is that you don't have to believe it. You just need to do the work to get there. Because I think inside all of us, and especially people who came from such trauma, you've got that little kid inside of you who doesn't trust and doesn't believe anything, doesn't believe anything good can happen. But it's kind of like, you know, taking one of your own children small to the dentist and they're terrified to go. You can talk to them all you want. It's not going to make that much difference. Sooner or later, you have to take their hand and gently take them there. And only after they've gone do they realize that, wow, that wasn't so bad. And I think this is the same thing. There was a part of me that was so skeptical through the whole thing, that played those tapes in my head. Are you kidding? You're too dumb, etc. In fact, I have a little story about that. I remember one Sunday in January, I'm up in Price County, a blizzard's going on outside, and I got up and I was going to work on my writing, not on a story, but work on learning to write. And I just woke up in one of those moods where I didn't believe in anything, and I, you know, sat down to type, and I thought, get real, you know, are you kidding? You can't even punctuate, and you're going to become a writer. So I decided I wasn't doing that day. My husband was home. The kids were there. There were leftovers. I grabbed a box of Oreos, a jug of diet soda, and a pack of cigarettes, and a stack of library books, and I went back to bed. And I said, I'm not coming out today. I decided I wasn't doing my life that day. I was going to escape in a book is what I was going to do. So I picked up the first book on the staff or stack was Tawny O'Dell's Backroads.
Uh-huh.
And she was a brand new author then, and I read the back, and I thought, wow, this sounds like a dark, miserable story, probably worse than mine. I'll feel better when I'm done reading it. And I read all day. Now, when I learned that I sold my book, when my agent called to tell me that Random House wanted this book, one of my first thoughts, fast forward a little bit. When she called to tell me about who, you know, what was happening with the book,
right.
I thought back instantly to that day in January. If someone could have walked in my room that day and said, hey, that book that you're reading right now, 2 years from now, you're going to have your first book published, and that author that you're, whose book you're reading is going to blurb your book. I mean, wow. I would have thought, how surreal, but that is, I had to write to Tawny O'Dell and tell her that story once she blurbed Carry Me Home. Because, and I thought, well, isn't that life? You know, you never know where it's going to lead you, but you keep working, hoping it will take you in the direction you want to go. And I didn't believe it. Well, I shouldn't say that. My head didn't believe it, but the rest of me did.
It is a journey. You never really get there.
No, exactly. And so when I come across aspiring writers who really are talented, but who are doing the song and dance of trying to get published, and they want to give up sooner or later, you know, if it's not going well, and most writers have to send out many, many query letters before someone reads their book and takes them on, I always tell them, but, you know, I could have given up on that day, too. You know, on that day in January, I could have given up. But just keep doing the work. Just keep working and working until you get there.
Sandra Kring, her new book is called A Life of Bright Ideas. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at UMR.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our regional author series continuing today with Sandra Kring, who has written five best-selling books right here in central Wisconsin. Sandra, a native of Wausau at this stage of her life, and this book that you've just written, A Life of Bright Ideas, as I was reading it, I could see that being turned into a movie. Have you ever had any interest in having somebody turn your work into a screenplay or doing it yourself?
Not doing it myself for sure, but I did have someone who had the film option for a time. I've since severed that because it looked like it was really kind of going nowhere. But I just got a brand new agent in a stellar agency in New York, and they do have agents for film and foreign rights and some of the things I haven't had so far. So I'm hopeful. We did have a producer while the option was tied up who was interested. So who knows?
They could take the two books, you know,
yes,
and turn them into one dynamite movie.
Yes, they could. They could. You know, when I'm writing my books, I always see them like movies. That's how I write. The story kind of just unfolds in my mind, and I'm really typing just what I see.
And your imagery is very visual, very specific. You know, some writers write that way and others don't, and you do.
I do.
How important are agents to writers?
Very important, actually. However, of course, now we do have self-publishing via the e-readers, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. But on a whole, they are very important. You know, who would want to face contracts by themselves? You want someone who knows what they're doing, of course.
And what about editors? You work with an editor. Have you ever been in a position where you've refused to work with an editor?
No, not refused to work with them, but refused to make changes they suggested, yes. I've had four editors now. Editors change in publishing houses all the time. So I've had four. And my editor that I had while I was working on A Life of Bright Ideas was quitting the business altogether and going to pursue another career. And she did finish the book with me. I was already paid for it, and a new editor came on the scene, and she did ask for changes. I made very few of them at that point.
And how do the editors react when you do that?
You know, they're really good about it. They really are. They understand from the beginning that, you know, agents and editors both, that it's your story. They make suggestions, and I always give all of their suggestions, you know, a couple days to think about it, because once you have a story in your head one particular way, it can be hard to switch gears. But sometimes they're right, and sometimes I don't feel they're right. So I just do what I think is best for the story.
And you told an interviewer there's only one mistake an aspiring writer can make, and that's to not write in their authentic writer's voice.
Yes, yes. I think, every aspiring writer is an avid reader, And we formulate this idea of how a writer is supposed to sound. Now, to me, my books don't sound like real books to me. They sound like me. And somehow that doesn't, you know, seem like a real book to me. And I think we're all like that. Our voice is boring to us. Let's face it. Our stories, our thoughts are boring. We live with them every day.
But if you try to sound like somebody else,
you're going to fall flat. You know, what the publishing world doesn't need is a generic form of a popular writer. You know, they're not looking for that. They're looking for fresh voices, authentic voices.
And Sandra Kring, you are a fresh, authentic voice.
Thank you.
Sandra Kring, A Life of Bright Ideas. It's a brand new book, and thank you so much for spending some time with us for a second time here on Route 51.
And thanks so much for having me, Glenn. I enjoyed it.
When the truth is found to be.
We want to thank today's guest, Central Wisconsin author Sandra Kring, whose new book, A Life of Bright Ideas, has just been released by Bantam Books. You can find out more about Sandra and her work at sandrakring.com. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producers, Jane Ritger and Crystal Bennis. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by the Beatles and by Jefferson Airplane. Thanks again for riding along with us today. I'm Glenn Mobert. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we are heading out of town.
Yeah.